All right, what's up, and welcome to episode 39 of the Jake Talk Sports podcast. I am here today with one of my most anticipated episodes so far. I am here with the host of the Locked On Raptors podcast, Mr. Sean Woodley. How you doing, man?
I'm good, Jake. Thanks for having me, man.
No problem. Today we're going to be talking about all things Raptors, talking about some reactions to the end of this season, talking about the 2019 championship a little bit, talking about some critical targets in free agency in the draft, and some players who might be at their end with the team. Starting off with, I want to talk to you about the 2019 championship, because obviously you're a big Raptors guy, and it was a long time coming. And so what was your reaction initially? Like, what were you doing? Were you at the game? Were you at home watching it? What was the situation there for you?
Yeah, so I had been covering that playoffs like in person throughout the end of the conference finals, which was pretty awesome. Had a really great time covering that. But because I write for a humble little blog, we only got one credential for the two of us who worked for Raptors HQ. And because my lovely former editor Daniel Reynolds had seniority, he ended up getting the finals credential. So I ended up not getting to cover the finals, but it ended up working out because I got asked to co-write a book with our pal Alex Wong, of course, from the Raptors show with Will Liu on the Sportsnet 590 The Fan. He had been approached about writing a book, sort of documenting the run through the season and the playoffs for the Raptors, a bit of a commemorative book that would release essentially as soon as the finals were over. And because Alex himself was covering the finals, he needed someone to just kind of help him out because there was just far too much to write over the course of like the 4 days that we had to put together most of the book. And so we co-authored it together, and I wouldn't have gotten to do that if I was covering those games. So it ended up working out pretty well. And so the final night of the game six in Golden State, I was watching the game at a little bar called Hurricanes on Bloor West near Lansdowne. It's a place I used to go to a lot when I lived in Toronto. Now I live in Hamilton, so we kind of made the pilgrimage there for the last three games of the playoffs because I just wanted to watch the game in a place where I was comfortable and knew that they had cheap beers. And so most of the stuff for the book had been pre-written already, but the last game, there was one last final little thing that needed to be filed for the book. It was like a blurb on the finals MVP. And I assumed Kawhi was going to win it. I wrote a Kawhi thing. I was just going to swap in a couple of quotes and stuff like that for it. But Fred VanVleet starts knocking down all those threes and screaming into the camera in the fourth quarter. And I'm starting to get a little worried that I might have to, after many, many drinks sitting at this table for about 6 hours, because we had to hold the table before the game, worry that I was going to have to write a full new blurb on finals MVP Fred VanVleet. Didn't happen. He just got the one vote from our pal Hubie Brown, so it's all good. But it was kind of a stressful affair waiting for that sort of news to come down. Afterwards, though, we brought champagne in the street. Went home, finished up a couple final touches on the book, and it was amazing kind of driving down Bloor Street. It's such a pre-COVID thing to have happened. We're just like high-fiving strangers going down the street, leaning out of the car, screaming at dump truck drivers to do their horn thing. It was pretty surreal, and one of the more sort of memorable nights of my life. I was up until probably like 5 a.m. just kind of reading and watching the post game stuff and just kind of too buzzing to go to sleep. And it was a pretty awesome night to kind of cap what was, to me, one of the most fun stretches I've ever had covering the team.
That was a really awesome playoff run in general, watching them beat the Sixers in seven with that Kawhi shot, and watching them beat the Bucks and come back from 2-0 down in that series against Giannis, which is crazy. Obviously you were living in that area at the time. What impact on the city did this championship have? Because obviously Toronto, when it comes to sports championships, have not had their luck as of recently besides the Raptors. So what kind of impact did this have on the city, and what was like the general reaction like after they won the finals?
I mean, it was a pretty big release, I would say. Like, a lot of pent-up sports rage for the last two decades in Toronto between the Blue Jays not really doing a whole lot and the Leafs being the Leafs and the Raptors, obviously, coming off of, 4 or 5 years of playoff disappointments to go through and win the whole thing. It was just so cathartic, and it seemed like everybody was just ready to party and ready to celebrate a big win. And I think you saw it at the parade, right? I mean, what was it, like 3 million people when all was said and done were at the parade at some point or another? I was down there right in the muck of it. Like, it was really, really amazing to see that many people just get on board. And, you know, I think there's always this sort of trepidation when it comes to like a team gets good and oh no, there's gonna be these bandwagon fans and all that stuff. And I loved it. Like, give me the bandwagon fans. That's awesome. More people care about the thing I care about. That rocks. Like, that's a great thing to have. And that was a really cool thing. I mean, you know, this was something that I think we probably don't even know the full impact of. We won't know the full impact of for like 15, 20 years, honestly. But, you know, my thinking is if Vince Carter had the impact he did on Canadian basketball and basketball in Toronto that he did, like, what is the Kawhi effect going to be? What is the effect of the 2019 Raptors going to be in 2035 when all these kids who were 6 years old when the Raptors won the title are coming up? And I can only imagine there's just going to be that many more kids playing ball, and that means there's going to be more really good kids who end up going to the NBA and stuff like that. So, you know, the impact I still think is probably a little bit far off to know fully to the extent of it, but obviously in the moment it was as celebratory as I've ever seen the city, as connected and together as I've ever seen the city and the surrounding areas as well.
What was the level of hope for Kawhi staying after? Because I feel like when I was after I had kind of been done like celebrating and stuff, I was just at home in New York. It after I had like been done watching it and stuff, and then I kind of like sat there and I'm like, what if we just don't have Kawhi next year, right? And like I saw a few things on like Twitter and like Instagram and stuff that were saying he's like in Toronto, he's talking to people, but I feel like he became such a big part of like the Raptors culture and like the city and stuff after the parade and stuff. So obviously it was tough to see him go, but was there a pretty high level of hope around town that he'd be around for a little bit?
I mean, I had talked myself into it by the time the season had come to a close and they won the whole thing. You know, I thought they needed to win the title to have a chance of keeping him, and they did. And so I thought, you know, maybe it's like a 1 year deal. He sticks around to see, you know, can we do this again? If so, maybe it becomes a longer term marriage. If not, maybe he goes and sort of lives out the LA destiny he always kind of telegraphed for himself. But yeah, I was pretty convinced that if nothing else, the Raptors had a really good shot of keeping him around and having him stick with the team. But once things started to come out, you know, the whole like plane, you know, drama, like the helicopter drama and all that stuff, it kind of got like so intense. And I was like, this feels like maybe we're grasping at straws. Maybe this is not actually going to happen. So I think my sort of belief day of parade was like the highest it's ever been when he does like the whole laugh and everything like that. People are chanting at him 4 more years and all this stuff. Kyle's chanting at him 4 more years from the stage. I thought, okay, maybe there's a chance here. But as that kind of week progressed and it got further and further out and there was no news, I was like, okay, this probably signals something bad. But like, look, they knew this was the risk going in, and they want a title. They have nothing to feel bad about, right? Like, winning a title is very, very hard to do, and they did. And I think, you know, had they not won the title, you know, I still think it was worthy of a gamble to try to go and win one with Kawhi Leonard, and, you know, you take your losses and move on from there. But the fact that they won it, I think, made the sting at once hurt a little bit less, but also in the intervening years, it's like, oh my God, had he stuck around, this team probably has two or three titles more to talk about because that team was stacked, absolutely loaded, and only got better from there in terms of like the role guys. You know, Fred VanVleet was not the player he is today back in 2019. Pascal Siakam, as good as he was then, is not the player he is today. Like, that team would have gone on to probably win at least one more title, maybe more, and that's where it kind of makes you feel a little crappy. But again, overall, you win any one title, that to me kind of gives you like a 5 year grace period to not be too upset about anything.
And so last little point about like 2019 and stuff. So you said that you were covering most of those playoffs in person. Did you ever have like any like in-person interactions with any of the players or the coaches or anything, or was that more like you were more away from that stuff still?
Yeah, not so much just because the playoffs, it's very sort of regimented. You know, there's the odd time you can get a player one-on-one, but it's pretty tough. You know, mostly sort of the more seasoned, you know, more main, like the longtime beat writers and stuff like that will kind of get that access. You know, sure, I could have gone for it if I wanted to. I'm not a necessarily very good reporter. And so it wasn't something I always pursued. But the playoffs, it's kind of like a full-on like you'll bring everyone out who you want to talk to, and they'll just put them on the podium type of thing. So nothing too crazy in terms of one-on-one interactions or anything like that. That's more of a regular season game on a Wednesday against the Hornets where no one else is covering the game. You can kind of get in there and have some chats with some guys where, and I mean, that's not even been a thing since the COVID and everything happened. So we can't even get in the locker rooms at this point, but you know, it's been a pretty cool thing. To you know, at the moments where you get those sort of weird nights where you get to chat with Jakob Poeltl about pick and roll coverage, that's always fun. But for the most part, the playoffs are a pretty regimented and sterile environment.
So yeah, and obviously, I think it must have been pretty special for you just to even like feel the energy of that team, because you could tell like how much fun they were having out there and how much they like had become a brotherhood more than just a team and stuff. So it was, yeah, it was really fun. Moving away from the past of the Raptors, let's talk about the present. Let's talk about what did we think about the Raptors this season? What did we get positive-wise from the loss to the Sixers in the series and stuff like that? And just overall thoughts on the outcome of the season. So, yeah, let's just start with the season. What players stood out to you that you didn't necessarily expect to and stuff like that? So what did you like out of the team?
I think the team went in a very interesting direction this season, right? They kind of punted the center position in a big way and said, hey, we're going to play this kind of new wing heavy, everyone's switchable, everyone's 6'9". Maybe our offense stinks, but we're going to offensive rebound the crap out of the ball to sort of make up for that, play the possession game, get on the run. And, you know, I don't know if it proved itself to be a thing that can hold up over the course of 48 minutes a game over the course of an entire season in playoffs, but like, what strategy is viable over 48 minutes over the entire season, right? Like, you have to have different things to fall back on, and as sort of like a pillar, sort of core foundation of the team and sort of their guiding principle going forward, I think they've proven that this can work, and that, you know, kind of going with a mismatch hunting style of ball where you have dudes who are 6'8 and 6'9 always finding a matchup out there because everybody's 6'8 and 6'9 and no one else can match that across the board. You know, I think it's sort of a natural progression in a lot of ways of the small ball stuff we saw in the mid-2010s from the Warriors and stuff like that, right? Where everyone in the Rockets, where, okay, everyone's small and skilled. What if everyone was big and skilled, though? And the Raptors, I think, kind of said, well, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. If everyone has guard skills but is also as big as a power forward or bigger, that is probably a way to exploit some matchup disadvantages for the other team. And I think they've proven that. You know, it doesn't work unless Scottie Barnes sort of takes off the way he did unexpectedly as a rookie. It doesn't work if Pascal Siakam doesn't become the offensive engine that he was by season's end. Like, you need to have, obviously, talent to let any of these things work and sort of have any sort of team-building model be successful. But I think they've proven that they've got the talent to make it work, and they've got the sort of principles to make it work as well. Could they use some matchup-proof elements to their team? Certainly. Like, you go up against Joel Embiid in the first round, I think that was kind of one of the positives is, yeah, you probably do want someone at the very least who can just go and absorb six fouls from Joel Embiid in a series, just to sort of, you know, give the other guys in your team some cushion and, you know, not have to guard him for the entirety of the game and pick up fouls and all that stuff. Like, that's probably something they'll want to address at some point going forward here, whether it's this offseason. I don't know if that's necessarily necessary. Like, that might be something that comes down the line, but I think for the most part, like, Vision 6'9", as it has been kind of branded, does have a lot of legs. And, you know, it's not perfect, nothing is, but the fact that you have guys like Precious Achiuwa, for example, who has big man skills, is 6'9", is as mobile as you could possibly get, can guard 1 through 5, having a guy like that on hand, along with OG Anunoby and Scottie Barnes and Pascal and Chris Boucher doing what he did this year as one of the more effective role players and bench players in the NBA, you know, I think they've proven that there is a little bit of proof of concept here, and I think I'm excited to see it kind of go to work a little bit more as they sort of try to diversify it up a little bit, maybe add some new wrinkles and things like that. But I think overall, pretty strong takeaways. I mean, they won 48 games. Their Vegas over-under was like 36.5. I don't know how you can come away feeling anything but really good about where this team is headed after that. They've kind of proven they're ahead of schedule already.
Yeah, and talking about the Sixers series a little bit more, when we first drew the Sixers and it was all set, there were a lot of people, NBA fans and Raptors fans, everybody kind of picking this as a very common upset pick. A lot of people were pretty confident in the way the Raptors played defense, being able to switch as consistently as they could and stuff. And people were not necessarily high on James Harden, obviously, because he had his struggles and stuff. And I personally was still kind of thinking we probably will not beat them because of the fact that Joel Embiid still exists. But I think that you said that really well. It's like, I love Precious, and I was just listening to an episode of your podcast of the Locked On when you were talking about him, when so you got some mailbag questions about him and about like Gobert, and you were like really high, you're really high on Precious, and I am too. And but still, like, it was Embiid. So I'm assuming, how did you feel coming into that series? Did you kind of board the hype train where maybe, hey, we can get this upset pulled off, maybe we can go get like crushed by Giannis and the Bucks again, or what are we thinking?
I certainly thought that they had a chance to pull it out. I picked Sixers in seven just because Embiid is Embiid and he's a lot to handle. But honestly, like, I think the Raptors were a couple of healthy games of Gary Trent Jr. at the start of the series away from probably winning the thing, man. Like, they had them figured out for the long stretches of that series. And, you know, I think James Harden kind of coming back to life in game six kind of sewered them. You know, this was always predicated, the chance the Raptors are going to win the series was always predicated on the idea that James Harden's kind of cooked and is not the same player that he used to be. But he had at least a couple of games of old James Harden in him. Whether he has that over the course of a full season, that is not my problem to figure out. That's on Philly to figure out, and I'm glad I don't have to figure that problem out, because that seems like a nightmare to try to reckon with. But I do think, you know, the series was in their grasp if, you know, you had James Harden playing at a lesser sort of state, because it allowed them to only single guard him and not have to send double teams his way, opening things up to all manner of open threes for Tobias Harris and Danny Green and Tyrese Maxey. You know, and I think once they kind of figured out, oh, we can just single cover James Harden here, we're not too worried about it, we can stick OG or Pascal and kind of have them swallow up Tyrese Maxey. Like, there's a pathway here to defend this team well enough to then outscore them at the other end. And, you know, of course, game three, you get that damn Joel Embiid three at the end. Like, what are you gonna do? It's a ridiculous shot by a ridiculous player, and you're just gonna have to live with that. But I do think it was within their grasp. I think if you play that series 100 times, the Raptors probably win it 45 times or something like that, you know, at full health, just because of the firepower they seem to have, and the lack of answers they seem to have for Pascal Siakam as well, who just carved everybody up. And you forget, like, Scottie Barnes missed two or three games in that series, 2.5 games with the ankle injury as well. Like, they were hurt, and they were not a team that was deep enough to withstand getting hurt to their main guys, and that is what I think ended up doing them in, that and out of body James Harden game in game six. But that was certainly a series that I thought they could win going in. I didn't pick them to win, but I thought it was on the table. And again, I don't feel badly about how it went. I thought they, you know, performed pretty well considering the injury stuff, and you wish some things went the other way, but overall I don't think you can have bad feelings coming out of that series for sure.
Let's talk about Gary Trent Jr. a little bit more. I've seen you on Twitter and on your podcast talking about how you're pretty heavily invested in the idea that he should fulfill his destiny as a sixth man, and you talked about on one of your episodes that he might be too expensive, or like trying to like extinguish that doubt and stuff. I just want to hear more about that. What goes behind your thought process of him being the first guy off the bench instead of starting for the team consistently?
He's very clearly the weak link defensively in the Raptors starting five from last season, like their go-to starting five. Yes, he got a bunch of steals, but like, that comes at a price. He jumps passing lanes. He gets out of position. He's not a great on-ball defender. He's not terribly strong or quick or anything like that. He makes up for that by, you know, hunting steals and getting them out on the run, which is important to what they do, but I just kind of think of all the guys who could be starters next season, you go through, I think, six guys. It's Fred VanVleet, it's Gary Trent Jr., it's Precious, it's obviously Scotty, OG, and Pascal. You know, four of those guys aren't going anywhere. OG, Scotty, Pascal, and Fred are starters. Like, full stop, end of story there in your starting five. And then it's just a matter of, all right, how do you better assemble the rest of the roster, figure out your rotation patterns, and maximize what it is you do well, which is, of course, play defense and get out running. And as much as Gary Trent Jr. is a big driver of offensive success for the Raptors, which he was all season long, I think if Precious Achiuwa is a 36% three-point shooter like we saw in the back part of the year, combined with the incredible defense he provides, you know, if you can get a little bit of improvement from, you know, from outside from Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam, and Pascal had a bit of a bounce back year this year from outside, I think you have enough shooting to get by there and have a functional offense without Gary Trent Jr., while also having maybe the best defensive five-man crew in the NBA if you have Fred, OG, Scotty, Precious, and Siakam together. Like, good luck scoring on that ever. Not a chance. You know, even their lineup data in the very small sample together this season, they were in, like, the second percentile in offense. Not at all good on offense, but they were ridiculous, literally 100th percentile in defensive efficiency per cleaning the glass, Ben Falk's site. And like that to me is something to go on. Like we saw this year in the postseason, defense is the thing that's going to win you games. It's very cliche, but like at some point we have to just accept that is fact about basketball, and defense is extremely important. The Raptors have prioritized it, and I think you prioritize it most by having Gary Trent Jr. come off the bench. And it also leaves Gary Trent Jr. with a chance to kind of go to work and, you know, get looks up, have a lot of say in the offense when he's on the floor, and also not overextend him to the point where you're asking too much of him late in games. And like, you could still close games with him for sure. There's no problem with that. If he's hot, if he's on a heater, if Precious is having a rough game, if Scotty's having a bad outside game or whatever, someone fouls out, you can easily close with Gary Trent Jr. and he's going to hit some big shots for you like he did all year. But I just kind of think in terms of allocation of the ball, he needs a lot of touches. Precious maybe needs fewer. Fred seems like he's going to have a bit of an off-ball role. OG's a really good off-ball player who has a little bit of on-ball chops. Siakam obviously is going to lead the team in usage. I think you're going to disperse the sort of ball around a little bit more if Gary Trent Jr. is coming off the bench and allow him to sort of carry those lineups for the Raptors, which, you know, as much as we love Thad Young and Chris Boucher and those guys coming off the bench, they weren't exactly running teams off the floor with their offense this season. They were incredible defensively. I think you kind of get more balance if you have Gary Trent Jr. kind of as the offensive center for those lineups. You know, kind of everything revolves around him, and then you can defend well enough at the other end against second units to get by with him on the floor, and I think you're pretty comfortable with it. He also just has gunner spirit. He has a six-man's, like, vibe just exuding from him at all times. Let him live out that destiny. Let him compete with Tyler Hero.
So who would be, like, if you had to pick a few of your standout players from this year that you weren't necessarily expecting? Obviously, like, Pascal and Fred, you know those guys. What are some guys that maybe you were looking at and you're like, I don't know, these guys could be liabilities, but they ended up being, like, really solid for the team?
I mean, the two guys are Precious and Boucher, I think. Like, Precious was so up and down to start the year, and there were still lots of downs as the season went along, but the ups became more frequent and a lot higher. And, like, I think to me, he's the guy that unlocks everything the Raptors want to do. If he can be your center, sort of do the things you need from a center, from screening to rebounding to roll gravity, pick and pop gravity, stuff like that, like, that is a super valuable player to have. He can literally guard anybody. He guarded James Harden and Joel Embiid over the course of single possessions in that series against the Sixers and did so very capably. And that is not a common skill set. You know, we talk all the time about 1-5 defenders in the NBA. It's actually a lot more rare than we'd like to suggest. Like, there are maybe 6 or 7 guys alive who are actually 1-5 defenders, and the Raptors might have 3 of them. So, you know, it's a great asset to have, and Precious is certainly one of those guys to me. And, you know, by the end of the season, he's shooting like 4 threes a game, hitting 36% of them. That is super meaningful, really valuable, and if you can kind of continue that progression along, not to say everything's linear and he's going to, you know, obviously take a big leap next season because these things take time and he's certainly a raw prospect. But I have such belief in his defensive upside that, like, the offense can be pretty marginal and he's still going to be an impact player because of how good he is at the other end. And then with Boucher, I mean, I've written Boucher off a lot. I have always kind of been a little skeptical on his ability to be a winning player on a good team. I think he was fine, you know, putting up big numbers on an awful team in Tampa when he had a lot of opportunity. That was nice, but I never really thought it meant anything. And there's a reason they were losing all of those games with Chris Boucher averaging 20 plus points for stretches. You know, she's just not that kind of winning type player who's going to carry the day, but he totally transformed himself this season, became an excellent defender, a lot more disciplined. And he also became just a killer offensive rebounder, which fed right into what the Raptors were trying to do to overcompensate for their lack of offensive punch. It's just, all right, crash the glass. And he was as good as anyone in the league at doing that this season. You combine that with the fact that he plays the Raptors' defensive style and all that stuff. He was really good despite having a down shooting season from outside. If he can even bounce back to, like, league average-ish next season, he's never going to win a sixth man of the year because that always goes to the dudes who score the most points. But if you're going through the list of impactful reserves this past season, Chris Boucher's on-off numbers are better than all of the guys who were in the running for that award, whether it's Jordan Clarkson, whether it's Tyler Hero, any of those gunner types. Chris Boucher did more to drive winning on the floor than any of those guys did this season for the Raptors. And I think he's a really effective piece. And I think he should be top priority this offseason for the Raptors to get him re-signed and brought back because he fits so well what they're trying to do and has proven, hey, I can play winning basketball and be a good player on a good team, that it's not just kind of putting up stats on a team that's losing a whole bunch. And I think that's a really valuable thing to have. So yeah, bring back Chris Boucher. He was an absolutely pleasant surprise this season after a really rocky start. He totally found his groove from like December on and was like consistently excellent for the Raptors coming off the bench.
Now to now that we've talked about all like of this past season stuff, moving on to where we are now, sitting in the off season, talking about like free agency. Okay, obviously we're pretty solid all around, but no team is perfect, right? So what position or any specific player did you have in mind looking at like things we should be targeting in free agency?
Yeah, I mean, I think shooting would be really valuable, right? Like if you can find some sort of combination of shooting and defense, even better. That's hard to find. You're not really going to find perfect players with the money the Raptors are working with. They only have about, you know, the $10 million mid-level exception to play around with, and that's a useful thing to have for sure, but you're always going to get flawed players with that. This is what they signed Kem Birch and Aaron Baines with, right? You're not getting star stud players with that amount of money, but I do think there are some interesting pieces out there. I think you could go sort of more of a defense and playmaking style, maybe less shooting, like a Kyle Anderson. It would kind of fit what the Raptors do quite nicely. I ultimately think the two skills to prioritize are shooting and ball handling more than anything else, just because the Raptors could use like some supplementary ball handling to help take the load off of Fred VanVleet and Pascal Siakam. There's a good chance Scottie Barnes does a lot of that this season, and I'm excited to see it, but there's never been too much ball handling on a team to sort of help you get you through certain stretches of games or stretches of season if guys get hurt. And I think Kyle Anderson to me is like a pretty high level target for me. I also think there's something to the idea of, you know, can you get yourself like a true blue backup point guard to play with Fred VanVleet to keep him from playing 39 minutes a game and getting ground into dust by the end of the season? If you can get someone, you know, someone who kind of was floated up there as a trade candidate was Monte Morris from the Nuggets. I think that would be like the perfect addition to this team to just sort of augment Fred. You can play two point guard lineups if you really want to and still be big everywhere else, so you're not feeling like you're super tiny like they were back when they were playing Norm Powell at the three or anything like that. So that those are kind of the spots I would look at. Center, I know everyone's kind of like, oh, they need a center. I don't think they need a center. I think a center would be fine and cool to add to the team, but not at like any great cost, because you want Precious Achiuwa, or at least I want Precious Achiuwa playing 30 minutes a game next season as the starting center. I want to see Chris Boucher sliding in there. I want to keep on seeing Scotty Barnes, you know, rotate in there to play some center, because he's proven he can kind of do the things you ask from centers. And I think his playmaking as like a short roll option is really intriguing, potentially as a thing to unlock with him there too. So I think the center position is all right. If they can find a JaVale McGee type to come in and fill in 18 minutes a game, great. You know, he's an extra guy who can soak up some fouls and stuff like that in a matchup against an Embiid. But for me, the perimeter is where I think they kind of need a little bit more juice, a little more downhill, a little more shooting. And I think that's what they should be prioritizing for sure.
Another name that I was thinking about on a more serious note, I don't know what his situation is currently with, I think it's the Spurs right now. I would not be totally against having Jakob Poeltl back.
A guy who I was pretty excited by at the potential, around the deadline, something around there, just as like a potential piece for the Raptors to go and try to add when they were kind of, you know, obviously ended up with Thad Young, but they had that sort of 33, or not, the first round pick and Goran Dragic deal kind of floating out there. Poeltl, I thought, made some sense. The money was a lot harder to make it work with him. My problem with Poeltl, I love Poeltl a lot. He's a fantastic defensive player. He'd fit the Raptors super well. I'm always skeptical about guys who can't hit free throws. And like, or how much are you investing in a guy who might not be able to be on the floor when things matter most? And maybe you're not investing in Jakob Poeltl to be your closing center, and that's fine. And this is how I feel. I talked about this on my podcast today, actually, with Nick Claxton. Exact same idea. Fantastic defender, checks every box, except the free throws give me pause. And can you really afford to be investing a ton of resources in a guy who you probably can't have on the floor in the last 6 minutes of a close game? You know, that's a serious consideration for me. And I, again, if Poeltl is your backup center who's playing 18 minutes a night and not closing games, awesome. That's totally fine to me because he's great. He's a great little passer. He's obviously one of the best pick and roll and rim protectors in the entire NBA. He's fantastic. One of the most underrated defenders, I would argue, in all of basketball. A lot closer to like the Rudy Gobert tier of defender than he is to like the sort of average defender, I would argue. But the free throws give me pause, and just this sort of the clunky fit with the lack of space and stuff like that gives me a little bit of pause as well. And again, if he's playing 20 minutes off the bench, that's fine. But how much are you investing in a guy who's playing 20 minutes off the bench? And is it worth investing that much in a guy who's playing 20 minutes off the bench? It's a difficult sort of calculus to pull off, and that's why I am not in a front office.
Yeah, so talking about, I heard you talk about in your podcast the possibility of trading up for the 7th pick and what that would mean and who we would take there. But assuming we stay at, what, we're 33 right now, yeah? Okay, assuming we stay there, again, like you said, you might not have a guy in mind, but if there is anybody that you maybe have, like, heard in circulation stuff about, like, who we might take there, what do you got there?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the 7th pick, just to touch on that, I mean, that's only, like, the OG Portland thing that kind of makes that even a possibility, and I don't think they should do that. I think OG's an excellent player. As much as the 7th pick might be a nice player, he might be OG one day. like, you already have OG, and he's making a great, he's on a great contract for the team and all that stuff. Not a great contract for OG. He's horribly underpaid, but, you know, it works out for the team and it makes him more valuable. So, no, I don't need another 20-year-old thrown in. They already got their draft luck with Scottie Barnes. I don't need to test my luck with a high draft pick again. But I also am a person, admittedly, who kind of thinks the draft is more gamble and guessing and luck than it is any actual science. I respect the hell of the people who do this sort of traffic in this stuff and know what they're talking about, but I still think so much of it is so unknown until we see these guys in the NBA. So I don't have terribly strong takes on, you know, any one guy. At 33, though, I do think I would prefer them go with someone who's a little bit more sort of ready to play. And, you know, you're not probably going to get a ready-to-play guy all the time in the second round. 33rd overall, you might. Like, we saw Herb Jones go, like, 35th last year. You don't want to always pull the best guy from the previous second round and say, well, we can get that guy, because that's very hard to do. But I do think, you know, this draft is kind of weird and amorphous, it sounds like. From, like, 15 to 40, it sounds like anyone can go in any order. So you might get someone who's first-round eligible or first-round quality at 33, and maybe they can jump in and be a rotation player, you know, by the time February rolls around or something like that after some G League seasoning. Kind of like Norm Powell, I guess, in his rookie season, I guess would be the sort of model you're looking at there. And I would prefer someone who kind of has role-player skills to fit in around the already sort of established stars of the team. Look, it's always nice to get more stars, sure, but you have Scottie Barnes, you have Pascal Siakam, there's already questions about how much ball there is to go around. I would prefer them to try to get someone who, in a couple of years, projects to be a very good role player on a team that's going to need role players around their expensive core. So if you can get someone like a Wendell Moore Jr. from Duke, who's like a 6'5", you know, sort of do-it-all wing who doesn't maybe have upside of a star, but has a little bit of sort of, yeah, he can put it on the deck, he can hit some threes, he's a good defender. That type of stuff, to me, the guys who fill in the gaps between the stars, is what I would try to be trying to go for here. Obviously, if you can get someone who's going to become a star one day, then you go ahead and do that. But it's so hard to pinpoint those guys and make them hit that I would rather just kind of go for the safe thing, considering they've already gotten Scottie Barnes in the door. That was their big sort of speculative, we think this guy could be a superstar, or maybe nobody else does. And they might have been right. And so why not go and try to, you know, collect guys who are going to be useful role players on future good versions of the Raptors, which, you know, they're not in, I think, win now mode, win or nothing, you know, mode just yet this season. But the 23-24, probably, if you can have a guy from this draft who's getting regular run on a cheap second round contract in that 23-24 season, who can do role player things, is not looking to be anything more than he's not, I think that's kind of the way to go for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One name that I think I was looking at pretty heavily, I almost 100% doubt that he'll fall, but there is talk about him falling to the second round. Johnny Davis, shooting guard out of Wisconsin. I'm sure you've heard his name at least a little bit. He's exactly kind of what you're describing. I do not think he has, like, superstar potential, but I do think he has a very good role player, and he fits that shooting, like, hole that we're talking about, like, free agency-wise. So if we want to have a guy who we can develop and who's young, I think Johnny Davis would be a great pick because he's a knockdown shooter from three. He's bounced all over the place playing in, like, some, like, college pro leagues. He averaged, like, 45 points a game in one of them, just, like, absolutely beating up on guys. So I like him a lot, and I'm, like, I'm a Wisconsin sports guy for the most part, so, you know, I've watched a lot of him. So I think that that would be a good asset. I don't know if you would agree that a shooting guard would be the best position to roll with at that point, but again, I think he kind of fits the things that we're talking about, like, hole-wise, if we don't get somebody in free agency that fits, like, that shooting aspect.
I mean, it sounds like Davis is probably going to be like a top 10 guy, so I wouldn't bank on him falling down all the way to the Raptors are. You know, I think I'm more kind of in the range of, hey, let's hope Wendell Moore falls, or let's hope Caleb Houston falls, or something like that. Again, I don't have a ton of knowledge on these guys. I'm just kind of going off what people say about them and then inferring, you know, what I think about what people say about them as sort of my own sort of analysis. It's tricky, right? But I think guard depth is very useful. You know, and more guys who can handle the ball, especially if they're like oversized guards, like a Wendell Moore, who's 6'5". Like, I think that's something to really value. Whereas, you know, I don't know if they need to go back and look for more 6-foot guards. If you can get some size to sort of augment the rest of the thing you're building here, I think that's probably the way to go. And it gives you insurance too, if, hey, maybe Gary Trent Jr. shows out this year and they can't afford to keep him around next year, or don't want to keep him around because he doesn't show out, and you have some insurance there potentially to kind of fill in if Gary Trent Jr. is on the move out of town, which I think of the main core guys right now is probably the most likely to not be on the team 2-3 years from now.
Last thing about like free agency and stuff before we move on, what is the whole like DeAndre Ayton situation in your mind? Because there has been a significant, like more than I thought, like more conversations being had about the possibility of that. We would probably have to give up a good amount, obviously. I mean, from the Suns end, it's not that bad of a deal because they'd probably be getting two young role players and he's not in their conference. But do you think that that is something that the Raptors should even like attempt to pursue? Because we're going to have to pay him a lot of money because he's wanting like pretty much the max.
Look, I think Ayton would be a good fit. Like, he's a really good pick and roll defender. He's a really good rim protector. He's pretty mobile. He can switch. Like, I think he would be a very useful piece for the Raptors, but I don't think he's worth like trading OG Anunoby for him, right? Like, I think OG and sort of his skill set, you know, you might say Ayton's a better player in a vacuum than OG. I think to what the Raptors want to do, and based on the contract as well, I think OG is a more valuable piece to them than Ayton would be. So that's where I kind of lose interest in that deal. Where it gets interesting is if Ayton is kind of probing his options, the Suns are looking around at what the options might be, and maybe there's not a really good fit there, and they're not going to get a great return, and they're sitting there like, all right, well, what the hell are we supposed to do? If they can somehow pull off Gary Trent Jr. plus like Kem Birch for DeAndre Ayton, like that is an absolute coup. 100% you do that, 10 times out of 10, all day. That's the great asset management, 100% go ahead. But that requires the Suns to kind of be desperate, I think, because like in theory, they should let him take the qualifying offer before just accepting Gary Trent Jr. for one season. Like, it's just as much risk, right? So I think it would have to sort of be that the other suitors maybe have fallen off or don't have good packages when it comes to sign and trades. They also would need like one of the non-cap space teams to be in that mix, right? Like the Suns or the Pistons, for example, could just go give him a max offer sheet and leave it in the Suns court to figure out whether they're going to match or not. I think that's probably more likely, honestly. I don't think there's a ton of legs to the Ayton thing as much as I think, you know, there's this sort of assumption the Raptors need a center, and I've said this before. I don't think they need a center necessarily. I think they would take a center if it fit their vision and was not going to come at the cost of too much in terms of resources, but I think OG for Ayton's too much resources, and I think Trent for him is probably just a little bit, like, not quite enough for the Suns to say, all right, this is the sign and trade we're going to do. So I think it's pretty unlikely, and honestly, give me Precious Achiuwa, man. I don't care. Like, 30 minutes of Precious at the center. That's all I need for next season. Figure out the center thing after you kind of see what you have after a year of full-time Precious at center. Exactly, right? Like, he could be an all-defense guy. He could be sitting there like, why the hell we trade for DeAndre Ayton? This was silly. Now we have too many centers. This is nuts. But, I don't think there's any sort of real pressure to go and get a center right now. And I don't think Ayton is quite of, like, the superstar tier. Like, if it's Karl Anthony Towns, hell yeah, sign me up. OG for Towns today, done, let's go. I don't think the Wolves are doing that, but you're throwing in extra stuff for sure, as much as Raptors fans might be like, Towns? OG? Like, obviously Towns is a better player. He's an All-NBA center. He's like the best shooting center of all time. That's the kind of guy I think the Raptors would go and, you know, spend a bunch of chips on. I don't think Ayton is quite that tier.
Obviously, yeah, like, pre like D'Angelo Russell and like Anthony Edwards, like Wolves might actually like entertain that thought. But now that they're like, you know, with Patrick Beverley and D'Lo and Anthony Edwards, they have a chance to maybe contend if they can do some things in free agency and draft well. And so I don't think there's any way they're moving off of anybody. And so they kind of fizzle out as like a core, which they have not yet. Obviously Anthony Edwards is just absolutely insane. And he's only been in the league for 2 years. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So moving on to one of the last Raptors related points. What players do you think might be at the end with the team after this past year? If there's any that you know, like, for sure might be on their way out at this point.
Yeah, it's tough, right? I mean, Boucher and Thad are both free agents, so there's certainly candidates there. I think Boucher is pretty likely to come back. I would say, you know, I'd probably put it like 85% or something like that. I think the Raptors are pretty incentivized to keep him, and they have the money to keep him around, I would think. Even if it's just like a one-year balloon payment, they have like $21 million bucks to work with Thad and Boucher as their main free agents. Utah as well. I don't think Utah is probably going to be back at this point, which is a bummer, but just hasn't quite shown enough. Thad Young's interesting. Like, I think it's sort of one of two things with him. He's either going to stay with the Raptors on like a $5 million deal because he has found his 6'8" basketball utopia where he's having a great time and everyone's the same size and everyone throws cool passes and he's happy. Or he decides to go ring chasing somewhere, or he goes back to Chicago where he had a really good time playing for the Bulls, where they have a dire need for someone like Thad Young right now. So I think, you know, it's a little less likely. I would say it's like 50-50 probably for Thad. I'm not totally sure. I think the Raptors would like to keep him, though, because, you know, the first thing Masai mentioned in his post-trade press conference back at the deadline was, we got his bird rights. Like, this is important to us. We got his bird rights. I think that matters to them. They want to use those bird rights to keep guys in town. Other guys, I think, you know, Malachi Flynn's out there is like the classic. Well, here's the thing. I think he's staying because I don't think he has any trade value. And I think there's this like delusion. There's kind of this delusion among Raptors fans where it's like, well, that Malachi Flynn in the second, could they get into the first with that? And it's like, I don't think any team's taking Malachi Flynn, man. Like, there's just no way. No, it would have to be Malachi plus the second round pick for like, what, the 24th pick, which they already traded out of in the Thad Young trade. Like, they're pretty comfortable not picking in the first round. So I don't think Flynn has like any meaningful value to anybody around the league. He's kind of had 1 week of his NBA career where he was legitimately good. We're not going to count the end of the Tampa season where you run rookie of the month. Like, that barely counts to me. That was a fake end of the season where Ken Birch looked like he was going to be some kind of savior for the center position. And that's just not the case. So I think Flynn, yeah, it doesn't count. Flynn, I think, could be on the way. Also, Ken Birch, I think there's a chance they move on from him just because of the money and sort of reallocating resources. He might be a salary matching type piece as well, $7 million bucks for the year. It's not like it's an albatross contract, but I think it was pretty clear he was kind of the weak link in the Raptors' big man core last year. And he was obviously hurt a lot, got hit in the face 10,000 times, broke his nose, had a really tough season with quads and knees and stuff like that. So maybe a full season of health in Ken Birch can be a valuable backup center for you, and that's totally fine if that's the case. But I could see them maybe moving off from him, kind of like they did like a Corey Joseph, for example, right? Like a guy who's fine to have around, but you could probably upgrade that spot, and it might require shipping that money out to sort of reorganize things in order to do so. So, yeah, I don't feel like anyone else is on the way out. Like, I think Trent and Fred and OG and Siakam and Barnes and Achiuwa, like, those guys are all for sure there. End of bench guys, we'll see. But I think for the most part, it's sort of the Boucher-Thad duo and then Flynn and Birch.
That is all I've got. Thank you so much for coming on, talking about the NBA, talking about the Raptors. If you want to plug your socials or your show or anything, now's the time to do that. Go for it.
On Twitter at Woodley Sean, you can listen to Locked On Raptors every day. Also watch it on YouTube Monday through Friday. We talk about the Raptors a lot, man. It's off-season time. The draft is not terribly intriguing this year because they have one second-round pick. So it's not like last year where it was Scottie Barnes and Jalen Suggs and Evan Mobley every day. But still a good time over there, and we'll have free agency and all that stuff covered for you going into daily till the end of July as well. So thanks for following along.
Yeah, thanks again so much for coming on. Appreciate you. And we'll catch you later.
Yeah, happy to do it, man, anytime.